Thank you, everyone, for coming. We are delighted to have joining us the Deputy Chief of Mission from the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo, my good friend Kurt Tong, and the Editor-at-Large for Sankei Shimbun in Washington, D.C., Yoshi Komori. We will turn first to Komori-san to give us both the results of the election, which most of you know. It was a landslide. A shellacking, I think is the official phrase, of the Democratic Party of Japan by the LDP. The only thing to keep in mind is the last two elections were also shellackings by one side against the other. Komori-san will give us the results, his take, his analysis of what they mean, how to interpret where Japan's politics are going. And then Kurt Tong will talk about the U.S.-Japan alliance, U.S.-Japan relations going forward. I'd like to then get a little bit of a dialogue going up here, and then we'll open it up for questions and a discussion from the audience. Result was particularly interesting for us at CSIS. We have now two CSIS employees in the Diet, Koizumi Shinjiro and Tsuji Kiyoto, who is his replacement as research assistant in the Japan chair. I can also claim one other, Nagashima-san from the DPJ, was my research associate when I was at CFR. So last night, Tsuji-san called me and said, tell anybody who wants to get into Japanese politics, don't go to the Matsushita Seikeijuku, go to CSIS. But as Kurt will quickly point out, as a loyal Princeton alum, there are also Princeton alums and SAIS alums, so it's quite an international representation in the Diet. So let me turn it over first to Yoshi Komori to tell us what happened, why, and what it means.
Okay, I'll start from the scratch. Good afternoon, everyone. To begin, I would like to thank Mike and CSIS for holding this symposium. The U.S.-Japanese alliance is, needless to say, the pillar of Japan's foreign policy and national security. It is always good for our partner, the U.S., to gain a better understanding of us. And getting to the subject we are here to discuss, let me run through some of the distinct features of the campaign leading up to Sunday's election, and discuss the election's outcome, and finally address its implication for the alliance. The first notable feature of this campaign is the proliferation of political parties. As many as 20 parties fielded candidates for parliamentary offices, and some parties were very hastily organized. The Tomorrow Party of Japan, that's Nihon Mirai no Kai, that's the English translation that they chose for their own party. Tomorrow Party of Japan for one was established literally overnight by Ichiro Ozawa's renegade group that split from the ruling DPJ, the Democratic Party of Japan, merging for this election with an environmental protection group headed by Governor Kada of Shiga Prefecture. The second feature of this election is the disarray of the ruling DPJ and its resulting extreme unpopularity. Its malfunction as a political party led to internal splits and plummeting public support. This disarray, in fact, was the main cause for the emergence of numerous new parties. A third feature is the issue orientation of this campaign. Compared with the past general elections, the publicly presented and debated issues were more numerous and more clearly defined this time. The most vocal and visible issue among them concerned the future of Japan's nuclear power plants. And other familiar issues include the national consumption tax and the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The opposition parties also highlighted national security and Japan's diplomacy as areas of failure by the ruling DPJ. And notably, the proposal for constitutional revision was presented in an unambiguous and frontal fashion as a campaign issue, for the first time in a post-war general election. The winning LDP, headed by Mr. Abe, the Shinzo Abe, called for revision most vigorously, but it was not alone. Tokyo Governor Shintaro Ishihara's Restoration Party, Ishin no Kai, also made it a policy objective for their candidates. And the small but vocal Everyone's Party, as Minna no To, and even smaller Kokumin Shinto, it's a People's New Party, both highlighted constitutional revision as a campaign pledge. So you may find it interesting that the U.S.-Japanese alliance, which is the main subject of this gathering, did not emerge as a campaign issue. This is not for lack of interest among any of the political parties or the Japanese general public. On the contrary, it is because support for the alliance is almost unanimous among the parties, and the overwhelming majority of the public considers the alliance as a necessity for the country's national security and defense. The only political party that clearly opposed the U.S.-Japanese Security Treaty is the Japan Communist Party. The former Socialist Party, now calling itself the Social Democratic Party, does not openly oppose the alliance but objects to measures to strengthen the alliance. So now, turning to the election results, let's take a look at what has what transpired in Japanese politics in the December 16 election, in which ruling DPJ suffered a defeat of unprecedented proportion. The party's seats in the lower house plummeted from 230 down to only 57. And it was basically obliterated as a viable political party for governance. In contrast, the opposition LDP increased its seats from 119 to 294, securing a simple majority in the 480-member house. And then the brand new Restoration Party won a whopping 54 seats, establishing a clear mandate as the new third force in the lower house. So the relatively new Everyone's Party, whose platform coincides closely with that of the LDP, lifted its representation from 8 to 18 seats. Finally, the LDP's coalition partner, Komeito, or Clean Government Party, also boosted its seats from 21 to 31. Taken together, the LDP with its own simple majority, together with the coalition member, will command a two-thirds supermajority. And importantly, this will enable the LDP to pass legislation that it seems important, including legislation voted down by the upper house. So the upper house seats were not part of last Saturday's election, of course, and in the upper house, no party holds a majority. So this created gridlock for the ruling DPJ when government could not override a vote in the upper house, but Sunday's election outcome means that this should not to be a problem for the incoming LDP government. So for those looking at the issues talked about in Japan, another very interesting feature is the defeat of the new Tomorrow Party of Japan, which ran a single-issue campaign advocating the removal or shutdown of all nuclear power plants from Japan. And this party held 62 seats until Sunday, but after the election holds only 9. Their devastating loss can be interpreted as lack of public consent for the party's position rejecting nuclear energy. So by way of contrast, the LDP platform called for continuation of the use of nuclear energy, at least for the time being. And this result is probably good for U.S.-Japanese relations because the alternative would have led to stopping of Japan's cooperation with the U.S. on nuclear power. Now, what are the implications of the election outcome for the alliance? Above all, it is worth noting that parties calling for a stronger U.S.-Japan alliance all increased their seats in this election. The parties that advocated constitutional revision did the same. And similarly, parties that highlighted the need for firmer response to the recent set of national security issues facing Japan, beginning with the Senkaku Islands, also fared much better than those parties that said little or opposed firmer measures. So right after the election, Mr. Abe reiterated his support for the alliance and intention to take measures to increase Japan's defense contribution and cooperation consistent with the national interest of both our countries. Steps he's reported to be considering include increasing Japan's defense expenditures and intensifying efforts to resolve the set of U.S. base issues, starting with the FTEMA. And perhaps more importantly, in a long-term sense, LDP has pledged to lift the post-war self-imposed ban on Japan's exercise of the right of the collective self-defense, thus making the U.S.-Japan common defense undertaking more smooth and more coordinated. Incidentally, the lifting of this ban has been advocated by the Restoration Party and also by a sizable number of members of the current ruling DPJ. On the issue of constitutional revision, election results offer encouragement for those who favor it. And this is a point in the LDP's campaign platform that increasingly the platform that did not encounter much opposition by other parties or by the general public. So in the wake of Sunday's victory, Mr. Abe repledged to push for it. But realistically, however, constitutional revision is a long shot. As many of you know, it requires a two-third majority vote of both houses of the parliament, plus a majority in the national referendum. Japan's neighbors reacted to the Sunday election quite as expected. State-run media in China, and as well as in North Korea, wasted no time in denouncing Mr. Abe as a dangerous militarist and a hawk. It is understandable that those who do not like the U.S.-Japan alliance would be unhappy with the Japanese leader committed to strengthening it. The absurdity of their characterization of Mr. Abe as a militarist, though, is not lost on the Japanese public, which is very unhappy with the increasing regularity of the territorial incursions by the Chinese paramilitary and North Korean missiles purposefully threatening Japan, which is the most peaceable, the most anti-militaristic country in the world. Much milder, yet similar labeling of Abe as a right-winger, a hawk, or a nationalist has been seen among South Korean and American critics. But he does not deserve these somewhat derisive labels. It is intriguing that these critics do not seem to pay attention to Japan's and Mr. Abe's track record, supporting the alliance and our common values of democracy and human rights. Japan is an international anomaly when it comes to national security and defense. And constitutionally and institutionally, the country bans military and defense undertakings that would be thought entirely normal by other sovereign nations. For example, Japanese self-defense forces stationed in Sudan or southern Sudan with the UN peacekeeping forces are prohibited by Japanese rules from engaging in any combat, even for self-defense, and therefore have to have a Bangladesh military forces assigned to protect them. Therefore, I dare say the use of terms such as militarist or Japanese militarist or Japanese hawk is an oxymoron. What Mr. Abe and other political leaders in several parties seek to do is to correct this anomaly and fill the void for the nation's defense. So the election this time indicates that the majority of Japanese agree with this effort, and perhaps in no small part due to the aggressive behavior of Japan's immediate neighbors. For the U.S.-Japanese alliance, the result of this election are only positive, and the U.S. administration should find an even stronger partner in Japan as it moves its own Pacific and Asian policies forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Kurtong.
Thanks, Mike. Good afternoon, everybody. It's fun to see a lot of old friends here in my old hometown. And I wanted to start, actually, by just taking note of the fact that we've this week experienced a huge loss in U.S.-Japan relations with the passing of Senator Inoue. I think everyone in this room would agree that Senator Inoue was an immensely important leader in the U.S.-Japan relationship, as well as probably the most important leader in the Japanese-American community. And so it's really, on behalf of my mission in Tokyo, I'd just like to take note of that fact, and it's with great sadness that we mark the passing of Senator Inoue. With regard to the election, I'm not Japanese. I didn't vote. I watched people go to the polls. They seemed to be moderately enthusiastic. It was a nice day on Sunday in Tokyo, good weather. Despite that, the turnout wasn't particularly high. But as a non-Japanese citizen and certainly as a foreigner and a diplomat, I shouldn't pass too much judgment on the election per se. But I did have some things that I found that are noteworthy about this past election. The first is that I very much agree with Mr. Komori on the fact that this election was very substantive. All the parties put out very clear policy positions, debated them openly, and the public was quite engaged in that effort. And there seems to be a clear desire both on the demand side of that equation as well as the supply side to have a very substantive conversation in the political realm and in connection with elections. And I think that's noteworthy as a development in how Japanese politics work. Related to that, the other interesting thing, and this should come as no surprise, is that by far the most important issue in the election, among the issues that were discussed from the perspective of Japanese voters, or at least as they responded to opinion polls, was the state of the economy. If you look at the opinion polls, it's very clear, one after another, that when asked why are you going to vote the way you will, and what are the most important issues for Japan, and the issues that will determine your vote in this election, far above any other issues were issues related to the state of the economy, employment, Social Security, and then along with a sense that a number, apparently a lot of the electorate felt that it was time for a change in leadership. So I think that's noteworthy. And another noteworthy fact is that very consistently across all of this data that was being collected is a rather large population in Japan of people that don't associate specifically with either of the major parties in the lead-up to the election or even any of the third, quote-unquote, third parties. The party that we have given the nickname to, the NOTA party, N-O-T-A, none of the above, is by far the most popular party in Japan. And that's an interesting development, as is the consistent pattern of new governments as they're formed losing support quickly over the recent years. And so I think that's a noteworthy development that we should be thinking about as we think about what will happen in Japan going forward. And in fact, it should sound quite familiar to people living in Washington. People care about the economy. People are a little bit concerned about their leadership and whether their you know, elected officials are doing what they want them to do, and voters say that they'll be happy to punish perceived non-performance by elected leaders. So this should all be very familiar to Americans. But I actually, based upon all of that and also just the overall situation in Japan and in the U.S.-Japan relationship, want primarily today to inject a real strong atmosphere of optimism about the state of the relationship and the opportunities going forward in the U.S.-Japan relationship. Just as Mr. Komori pointed out, all of the major parties, without exception, had strong U.S.-Japan relations and maintenance of the U.S.-Japan alliance as a major part of their platform. And that reflects public opinion. Consistently across the board, we see amazingly high support rates for the U.S.-Japan alliance and the relationship, the special relationship of Japan with the United States. In fact, that reflects a situation where U.S.-Japan relations are already in extraordinarily good shape. We have, as I said, strong support from the public. We also have exceptionally good coordination between our two governments on almost all matters of concern between the United States and Japan, whether it's North Korea or global developments. And in almost every area, there's been excellent communication. And I must say that's been true even as Japan has experienced changes in leadership by party, not just by individual, but by party. We have, I believe, demonstrated over the past decade that the U.S.-Japan relationship, the U.S.-Japan alliance, is not dependent upon the existence of any party on either side of the Pacific being in control of the government, and that's a good thing. That is a great foundation for cooperation going forward. Now, looking at 2013, what should we anticipate as being the situation next year? There's a lot of attention given to headline issues, and I imagine people will probably raise some of these during the course of the afternoon. But what I would like people to focus on is really the opportunity for forward progress on what I would call long-term investments in the strength of the U.S.-Japan relationship, the strength of Japan, and the strength of our partnership going forward. Really, it's the infrastructure of the U.S.-Japan relationship that in which we should invest and which we have a great opportunity to make forward progress on going forward in 2013. And for this purpose, I'd like to broaden the definition of the alliance a little bit to include things which are in the economic and also the person-to-person realm. So what are some of those opportunities in 2013? In the alliance area, in the military cooperation area, certainly 2013 is the year where we should break the bottleneck associated with moving the Futenma airfield to Henoko in northern Okinawa, as has already been agreed between our governments. This is the right time to make progress on this, and I think we can do that going forward. There are other important issues that we can tackle going forward in information security, questions related to interoperability and defense industry cooperation, pushing forward with the Guam relocation of a portion of the U.S. Military presence, and also taking a careful look at our goals and objectives in the alliance. There's work that can be done in that area. And I think everyone has been talking about this for quite a bit, and none of this is particularly noteworthy of me to point out, other than to say there's every reason for optimism that we'll be able to make progress on these issues in the months ahead. On economic affairs, of course, there's a huge opportunity facing us, particularly facing Japan, if it can find a way to participate in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Initiative. Now, of course, this is a decision that's up to Japan to make, but it may require some important decisions on the Japanese side. But in my opinion, clearly this is in Japan's national interest, and it's a big opportunity for the nation, as well as an important opportunity for strengthening the U.S.-Japan economic relationship. But there are other areas in the economic realm as well that I would expect to see a lot of activity on in the coming year, including good communication and coordination on our respective approaches to nuclear power. One interesting piece of that is Japan's possible participation in the Convention on Supplementary Compensation. There's lots of work to be done in the areas of cybersecurity. We have an excellent dialogue with Japan and cooperation on questions related to regulation of the internet economy and space. And there are certainly great opportunities in science and technology cooperation as well. As in law enforcement cooperation, there are some good opportunities in that area as well. The third element, which I think needs more attention in the U.S.-Japan relationship going forward, is finding a way to strengthen the people-to-people interaction, the human-level interaction between our two societies. This includes both academic exchanges, but also grassroots opportunities, as well as finding a way to increase the flow of students back and forth between the United States and Japan. And I think there will be good opportunities in this realm as well. One piece of outstanding business in the person-to-person area is the question of Japan's accession to the Hague Convention on Parental Child Abduction, and we can be hopeful of progress on that going forward as well. So I throw all these out not to allow for any particular areas of emphasis, but as examples of really a target-rich environment for the U.S.-Japan relationship for cooperation and joint action going forward, and would like to inject into that a sense that really it's hard to identify any special impediments to making progress on these issues going forward. We have two governments which are highly committed to this relationship. We have a rich agenda for action, and I think that we should look forward to a very good year in 2013.
Great. Thank you. The normal think tank thing is for the moderator to praise both speakers before they give their talks, and I've decided we need accountability, so I now save my introductions for after the talks. And I can safely say that we have two of the best speakers we could have had. Yoshi, thank you for a very rich and comprehensive assessment of what happened, where we're going. And Kurt, thank you for stretching the bounds of what DCMs can do and giving us a very full sense of what's on our agenda and what's possible with Japan moving forward. I'd like to ask Yoshi a question, and then you, and then perhaps we'll open it up. I mean, we will open it up. It strikes me that, this was the third wave election in Japan in as many elections. Koizumi 2005 won a landslide. DPJ 2009 won a landslide. Koizumi now won a landslide. I was speculating with someone this morning whether any other developed democracy has as large a floating vote or swing vote as Japan has. I think in most U.S. presidential elections, you're fighting for maybe not even 10% of the electorate. Canada used to have big swing elections, but they're over it. Most European countries don't have this kind of wave election, and it raises one question, which is Abe just going to get swept out, or the LDP just get swept out next time? When does Japanese politics hit equilibrium? Do we get to the long-awaited political realignment? is there going to be an opposition party that is actually viable? So what would lead an American audience to hope that maybe we're moving towards a more stable political system and not a fourth election the next time the Diet's dissolved that wipes out the current government?
I think discrepancy between sort of affiliation with certain political parties in Japan and policy aspects of that affiliation, this has always been huge and almost a cutout. So, for instance, LDP has had members, including the most senior people, whose views are so different from each other's. For instance, Mr. Nonaka, who's retired, has always been very skeptical, even sometimes critical, of the maintenance of the U.S.-Japanese security alliance. And in terms of how to deal with China, Mr. Kato, Koichi Kato, who was unfortunately defeated in this election, used to say that triangular relationship among three countries would be equidistant. That irritated some believers, or American observers of the alliance, you know, because I thought two countries, U.S. and Japan, were closer, you know, than each to China. So this is the ground for a major political realignment. Why not we have a political parties and its members, the respective members, whose views are more consistent with the party affiliation? And I think what happened in the last Sunday was one step forward or toward in that direction, the realignment. So as I said in my presentation, this last election was very much based on policies, policy manifestation, policy competition. And Restoration Party, for example, and it still has some way to go to come up to reach the point where the party itself can present a consistent and systematic set of policies. But I think we are making sort of a steady progress in that direction, if it's a healthy democratic undertaking, you know, to move. Did that answer your question?
It does. Yeah. Thank you. I mean, the corollary to the huge swing votes is that polling suggests that Japan's society or Japanese voters are much less polarized than the U.S., Korea, or many countries. So even though there's a huge swing one way or the other, the actual division of opinion is much less separated. Everyone in the Pullman polls is sort of clustered to the center right in a way you don't see quite the same in other democracies. So maybe that's one reason why we'll move towards equilibrium.
One thing I'd like to add, you know, that I've been paying attention to Japanese politics for more than about 30 years, 40 years, and we have come a long way in the direction of more cohesive or consistent sort of party affiliation versus party policies. You know, for instance, until maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the major political divide in terms of policies that reflected in the position taken by each political party is how a party sees the U.S.-Japanese security alliance. And it went, many years had gone with LDP having been the only major political party outrightly supported the alliance. Even Komeito used to oppose it. You know? So that's, we have changed, and I think in the direction that probably more sound and healthy.
So, Kurt, you're a well-trained diplomat, so if I ask you about Abe-san's plans for 2% inflation targets, then the Treasury Department alarm will go off in your head and you can't answer. And if I ask about when will Abe meet the president, your NSC alarm bell will go off and you can't schedule the president. And if I ask you about TPP, your USTR alarm bell will go off. So what's the answer to those questions now?
ding, ding, ding.
Red alert. But you've been talking quite a bit about the dynamics in Japanese politics. So, you know, Abe-san and the LDP won a huge victory, and they have the votes, as Yoshi said, to deal with the upper house if they have to. But there is an upper house election in July. So some of the speculation going into this lower house election was that Abe and the LDP would win, but they'd still have to be very cautious, particularly on a lot of the issues you just mentioned, until they can safely get through the upper house election. What's your sense of the terrain for the agenda you described and for U.S. engagement going forward from now to July?
We'll just have to see. I think maybe to frame the issue, you've already framed it, but there's any government has a certain amount of political capital, and there's a risk reward equations that any government has to think through, and I guess I just want to go back to the fact that I'm optimistic that whatever political capital is available, a good proportion of that can be invested in long-term investments in the U.S.-Japan and strengthening the U.S.-Japan relationship, and that I'm hopeful that we can find creative ways to facilitate that as governments and realize some forward progress despite the drumbeat of electoral politics.
Is it fair to say that of all the things you listed on your very rich agenda, that there's nothing inherent about the next 6-7 months to upper house that would make it impossible to move forward? In other words, there's enough room to explore all of them. The Japanese side obviously has to decide what the traffic will bear, but is it fair to say that the next 7 months up to the upper house are certainly not a red light for any of these issues?
Well, I guess the point I was trying to make is that the overall environment for these issues is quite facilitative. It's quite welcoming environment for progress, and that because many of these issues are ones that there is strong support from the Japanese public, then even with impending elections, there should be a possibility of forward movement.
And Yoshi, what's your answer to that question? Do you think the Abe government's going to have to consolidate and be cautious before July, or do you think they have some room to move issues they've talked about in the campaign or issues that Kurt talked about?
Mr. Abe seems to consider it imperative to secure at least a majority in the upper house, and then I think LDP supporters, many of them see a pretty good chance of accomplishing that aim. So my guess is that Mr. Abe and the followers would take a very cautious approach, cautious attitude, up until the time of the upper house election.
And I'm going to ask you another question, which if I don't ask it, someone in the audience will, and someone in the audience can ask it again in a different way if you like. On the label of Abe and the LDP as nationalist or militarist, I agree with you. I think it's completely overdone. I think some of the Western media headlines have conflated a bunch of different issues. And the bottom line, I think, is that the security agenda that Abe-san talked about, which, as we all know, Noda himself supported in many respects, collective self-defense, increasing defense budget, and so forth, that is actually quite welcome not only in the U.S. but in many parts of Asia, given the challenges posed along the East and South China Sea. But the part, I would argue, that would be problematic for any government in Washington, Republican or Democrat, would be if the LDP government actually followed through on some of the rhetoric about issues like the Noda statement on comfort women or certain proposals with respect to Takeshima or Tokto, without even addressing the morality or the politics or the history of any of those issues, I would think that for any government in Washington, anything that alienates Korea from Japan is just on its face strategically bad for us, given what North Korea is doing, given China's moves, and I think Chinese confidence that its pressure tactics are working in the East and South China Sea. I hear from lots of folks in Tokyo that, as you suggested, look, last time Abe-san, when he was in government, actually improved relations with Korea, improved relations with China. But I know Kurt cannot answer this question, so I want to ask you, what's your sense on these issues? I know, you know, after, in his first day two since the election, he's been quite prudent, careful, strategic in everything that's articulated. But what's your sense of how some of these issues play, particularly with respect to Korea, which for U.S. policy, just from a selfish perspective, could put us in a very difficult position as we try to deal with challenges like North Korea?
I think what you're trying to get at is how Mr. Abe will react on the issue of comfort women. And in the same context, probably visit to the Yasukuni Shrine as Prime Minister. That's something that's categorized as a history issue. And that's probably also a factor that could adversely affect Japan's relationship, not just with China or South Korea, but also with the United States. And my information, observation, that Abe is seriously calculating that risk. But going back to the origin of the issue, I know, Abe's response to these things, especially the issue of comfort women, would remind you that's a reactive. It's not that Abe stood up suddenly and then declared that whatever Congressman Mike Honda was saying is not true. You know, he was forced to make some comment on that issue by the introduction of the resolution into the U.S. House of Representatives.
2007.
2007, that was, when he was the last prime minister for the first time. But he's still not happy with the current situation. And it's not a secret that he is also critical of the Kono statement. And I'm sure most of you know what Kono statement. And in his mind, the only part of the issue that he really wants to take issue with is that sort of central contention that either Japanese military or Japanese government during the war, as a matter of policy and systematically coerced the recruitment of young ladies. No? And records show that there's no such thing. It's a Japanese military involvement in this prostitution, but the prostitution was legal in those days. But it's Japanese army or government never sort of ordered or perpetrated their forced recruitment. And on the contrary, in the case of some sad ladies in Indonesia, the sort of mid-level army officers on their own forcefully recruited some ladies, Dutch ladies, I think. And it was the upper authority found out and then stopped it. And later, these officers were arrested as a war criminal and then executed. So Abe clearly wants to set the record straight on that. And the Kono statement was interpreted as Japan acknowledging that forceful and systematic recruitment of young women. But again, and then he also sees that this is a moral issue, that an issue that has nothing to do with the current Japan's security policy or foreign policy. More like how you see what your parents or grandparents did. You know, it's a more of an emotional state of mind issue. And I think to his mind, there's a disconnect between current national policy for security or diplomacy and his effort to desire to correct, set the record straight. So again, will he do it? Will he take some action in the next few months? My answer is no, I think. So, but we'll see. The issue is there, not just on the mind of Abe, but on many Japanese. It's a question of national pride, dignity, and it's a sad thing. I mean, like prostitution in any form or anywhere. It's a something that we should denounce, but it happened as part of the war. And so there's a sort of feeling among many of us that picking this case up out of a historical context and then present it now and apply the current norms and ethics and judge Japan as a culprit. You know, that's, is it really fair? You know, what about the dropping of atomic bomb? All those things happened in the war. You know, and if you isolate and then take one case out and examine it to the contemporary standards, you know, is it, does it really constitute a fairness? You know, that's the kind of question we ask ourselves. You know?
I appreciate your very candid answer, and I know from my own discussions, as do many people in this room, that for Abe's generation, what you've said is a heartfelt sense of unfairness. I think, in terms of U.S.-Japan relations, people can debate what's fair, what's unfair. The question is what's smart, and as you yourself noted, this is not an issue that's smart foreign policy right now. And I agree with you personally. I think that that's well understood by many people going to this government. But I think it bears saying this in a forum like this and thinking about the consequences or implications of how this issue is approached. Without even getting into what's fair or unfair, just thinking in terms of what's in the national interest of Japan, what's in the national interest of the U.S. We may hear more from the audience on this. In a way, to my mind, it's unfortunate that much of the media coverage of Abe-san is focused on this issue. I know I raised it because it's in people's minds, but I did in part because there are many, many more dimensions to what Abe thinks about foreign policy that are obscured by this, which include his thinking about relations with other countries and even his statement, which has gotten fairly little attention, about the importance of Japan-China relations and his track record on that relationship when he was last in office. But I think people will be watching with great interest. I assume you want to pass on this one. but I do want to ask you a last question, then we'll turn to the audience. You got to the embassy about a year ago. So it was 2 years into the DPJ, but, you know, in the U.S.-Australia or U.S.-UK alliance, we go through changes of government on, you know, both sides of the Pacific, the Atlantic, regularly, and it's well understood, Labour or Liberal in Australia, Tories or Labour in Britain, Democrats or Republicans in the U.S., this alliance, these alliances are not something to be used as a pawn or in any way undermined by domestic politics. And in Japan, that wasn't the case, as Yoshi pointed out, for most of the Cold War, most of the 1955 system, because really only the LDP and eventually some smaller parties were in favor of the alliance. We're now, except for the Communist Party, in a period where all the parties are in favor of the alliance, but we had to go through this transition to the DPJ, and work through that. And I wonder what reflections you might have on what we've learned about how to build bipartisanship in the alliance from your perch in Tokyo as a DPJ. I mean, I don't know what will happen to the party, but as they leave power.
Well, I think some of the lessons you pointing out, I haven't served in Australia or Britain or Canada or other countries that experience frequent changes in leadership, but have extraordinarily strong relations with the U.S. But I think that as a group of people who work, and there's a lot of people in this room that are part of that work on U.S.-Japan relations, one of the things that we've all been learning as we go along is lessons that probably our colleagues in some of these other countries learned years ago, which is that it's good to communicate across the aisle. To have broad contacts and be inclusive in the overall conversation about issues of the day. And it wasn't so long ago when there was great controversy about whether people in the U.S. government should meet with people who were not in the Japanese government. But I think that that's kind of been settled now, and we all understand, and our friends in Japan also understand, that just as, say, the Japanese embassy or people in the Japanese government would meet with people who are not in the current U.S. administration in Washington, Americans would do the same thing with people in Tokyo. And I think that's one of the a good foundation for smooth transitions going forward, that we've, as the DPJ was administering Japan, we maintained very strong relations with a lot of people in the LDP, and I expect that going forward we'll do the same with opposition parties in 2013.
Thank you. That's a good answer. I mean, when I was in the NSC, early 2000s, it was clear that there was nervousness, discomfort in senior parts of the government, in the LDP in particular, with us doing too much with the DPJ or the opposition at the time. And I imagine that won't be an issue now, in particular because the people who survived in the DPJ are almost all people who worked hard on the alliance, with a few exceptions. A few of the stalwarts in U.S.-Japan alliance relations in the DPJ years did lose their seats, but most of those who you know worked hard on the alliance got reelected. So I agree with you. I think I'm pretty optimistic that even though the political scene will be fluid, the government will not only tolerate but welcome a lot more outreach to the multiple opposition parties that we now have in the Diet. Okay, thank you. I'd like to open it up to the audience. We have microphones. If you could raise your hand, and no speeches, please. in the front here, Bill. It's a race, and you win.
Thank you very much. I wanted to ask Mr. Komori, what role and what leverage or lack of leverage does Nukome have in this alliance? Because they're in the government, but as you pointed, or someone pointed out, there's an upper house election in July. Do they have any leverage, or are they just, and why are they there if they're not needed for an absolute majority?
I think Komei thought that the Clean Government Party does have a very strong leverage now up against the LDP. For one thing, like on the question of constitutional revision, the Komeito at least has a serious reservations, if not outrightly opposed to it. So Abe knows, other LDP leaders know, that they cannot proceed to start taking measures vis-a-vis constitutional revision. By the way, if I may digress a little bit, I think what LDP tries to do now is to change the procedure for the constitutional revision. That is Article 96 of the Constitution states the sort of procedure that says that the revision requires two-thirds of the approval in both houses of the Diet. The LDP wants to change that. And even to that, Komeito is not really coming along. So at least on the question of any measures designed to strengthen and deepen the alliance, Komeito often comes out and says, not quite clear, no, but they wouldn't say yes. So at this point, it's the official coalition government that is emerging and taking over. So Komeito is really a force to conjure with. It's important. But at the bottom of their heart, of people like Abe, is probably not so happy about the current situation. I don't know if I mentioned that. There's a thinking among some LDP leaders to go with the Restoration Party, which has 54 seats or something. It's quite a force. So we may be seeing as a very sort of intricate sort of maneuvering among those three parties on major issues. So again, to answer your question, Clean Government Party is important.
Could I ask Yoshi, if they don't go with the Restoration Party, which is to the... For the first time, you have an opposition party to the right of the LDP. If they don't go with them in coalition, what do they do, the Restoration Party? What's their role in opposition?
Restoration Party?
Yeah. What do they do if they're in opposition, if they don't come into coalition to replace Komeito, what does the Restoration Party do as an opposition party? Try to pull Abe to the right, push harder for Constitution, quietly cooperate? What role will they play?
I think if you look at the track record and the sort of seeming characteristics of the two top leaders, you know, Ishihara and Hashimoto, they could just be happy the remaining vocal and constant critics, you know, being outside the government, you know. They were sort of self-centered, very sort of, they like the grandiose gestures and all that, so I don't know. I don't think it's a part of a serious agenda for instance, Mr. Ishihara to be in the ruling party or ruling government, you know.
There goes your Christmas invitation to the Osaka party event.
Yonso Furumoto, Mainichi newspaper. I would like to ask about collective self-defense. If Shinzo Abe can successfully change the constitutional interpretation regarding collective self-defense, this can be a big step to strengthen U.S.-Japan alliance. But at the same time, some might argue that this is not a good time to do so, because Japan is in the middle of territorial dispute with China. China might take it very provocative action, and this actually can give China a good reason for further military buildup in the region. So is this a good time? Is this a good environment for Abe to go ahead with collective self-defense? Thank you.
Well, I think that's I'm not here to offer advice to Abe-san on any matters of Japanese constitutional law. But just let me say that efforts which improve our interoperability, and there's lots of elements to that, legal elements as well as communication elements, military investments, organizational elements, planning elements, lots of aspects of interoperability. That those are generally a good thing. That they'll improve the ability of the alliance to cooperate and function together. And that I believe is also respected by the region. More specific to your question. That the U.S.-Japan alliance is seen by other countries in the Asia Pacific as a valuable contribution to the overall peace and stability of the region, because it's not directed at anyone other than the defense of Japan and the United States, and it's a public good which contributes to peace and stability in the region. So I think that developments towards interoperability, viewed in that light, can be positive.
Would you be interested in my view too?
He used to work at
Mighty. I don't think there'll be any so-called good time for Japan to do it if you let reaction of China or North Korea, even South Korea, be the determinant for the timing. That's one point. So I think any time is good time. And secondly, it's lifting the ban on the exercise of the right of collective self-defense. That itself is a very abstract move that doesn't involve any hardware-related or hardware-based military actions. It doesn't mean that Japan will have missiles, offensive missiles. Doesn't mean we'll have a big aircraft carrier and that. It's just a conceptual policy change. But as you said, it's very important. And for the on the part of Japan, it would be very effective but costless exercise. I think technically, as I understand, Prime Minister can declare in the National Diet one day, and now we can exercise it. And that's it. It doesn't require any parliamentary approval or any other voting. So I don't know if that's how Mr. Abe feels about the issue, but that's my opinion.
I'll just give my short comment. I agree with both of my colleagues. My sense, I'm not in the government, my sense is some of our efforts to cooperate, roles and missions and capabilities, dialogue, missile defense, are reaching the limits of what is reasonable and practical because of the ban on collective self-defense and other things. So as, in my view, as Kurt said, if the aim is to make the alliance more effective, there's a lot to be gained. And as Yoshi said, in one sense, there's no good time to do it, because there will be some reaction. But the atmosphere does matter a lot. And so how the Abe administration handles relations with China and South Korea in particular will matter in terms of how smoothly this can move, not only in foreign policy, but in domestic politics as well. Because although Yoshi's right, the prime minister can replace the head of the Legal Affairs Bureau, that could become a very political and controversial thing. And so I think the international, just both in foreign policy, in U.S.-Japan alliance relations, and in domestic politics, setting the right atmosphere internationally is the way to go. I'm a big fan of Teddy Roosevelt. Speak quietly and carry a big stick. and so that's I can't give advice because I'm out of government. That's the advice I would give.
Your Grand Staff, why couldn't you just use the Germany and how it's rebounded from itself? It's surrounded by neighbors that it had taken over during the war. And why couldn't Japan just use that to bring about that?
Sorry, I used
why not do what Germany did?
You mean on the historic?
Right. On the path back to...
Supporters of Mr. Abe would argue against that. I think you proceeded with the assumption or the premise that what Nazi Germany did and what Imperial Japan did should be on the equal footing. But what the Nazi Germany did is at least attempt to terminate and exterminate the whole one ethnic group that had nothing to do with the war, and the decision had made on the highest level of the government. I don't know anything even remotely close to the action perpetrated or done by the Japanese government or Japanese military. So I cannot agree with your sort of premise that Germany and Japan are on the same footing. That
Shihoka Goto with the Wilson Center. Following up on Mr. Green's emphasis on the importance of atmosphere in building good relations within the region, I wanted to ask Mr. Komori about the role of the media and Japan-China relations in particular. It seems that there will be no quick solution to the Senkaku dispute. And at the moment, my understanding of the Chinese media is that it is very wary of what the Abe administration will bring. Are there any overtures, public relations wins that Mr. Abe could bring forward that could possibly win some hearts and minds in Beijing?
Hearts and minds in Beijing, do you mean people on the street or people in the government or a party? I think I would not oppose it. I mean, that it would be nice to be able to have some kind of communication between two peoples. But there's a sort of asymmetry in terms of each country's political system. And we can express anything, even against the government. I can go up to Mr. Abe's residence and say that down with Abe, and then I can walk away. And I don't think people in Beijing can do it, something similar. So the political asymmetry is one factor. I think that might prevent or hinder your idea. But I don't oppose any expansion or extension of communication on the level that is not on the government to government.
It's interesting. Last time when Abe came to power, the official media in Beijing and China was quite careful and did not, for example, box him into a corner by demanding he make promises about Yaskuni or other things as a precondition for a summit, because Beijing had done that with Koizumi. And once they told Prime Minister Koizumi, you can't have a summit unless you promise not to go to Yaskuni and some other things, you know, politically, Prime Minister Japan Koizumi sort of was in a box. What was interesting about that was it was quite clear that the Chinese foreign ministry thought it was actually giving an opening to Koizumi by showing the terms under which they could resume summits. And it backfired, and I think that was recognized in Beijing. So when Abe came in, they were much more careful. It is striking that this time the official media response to Abe, or for that matter, Mitt Romney, has been really quite aggressive and hostile and critical. I don't know personally what that means. You served in Beijing, you probably don't want to comment, the most important thing in my view is for the Prime Minister to have a successful summit here in Korea, which would be for the inauguration on February 25th, and in China. Personally, I don't think the order matters. For my part, I hope that China doesn't box Abe in and make that impossible, and I hope that the Abe government doesn't box itself in somehow, because I think my answer to your question is, as Yoshi said, there is a difference between the government and the people, but I think a successful, or at least a reasonably successful series of summits in the first quarter of the year would go a long way towards reassuring everyone, but that could be mishandled by either side. And it is different from last time Abe came to power, how the Chinese official media is painting him. So that's what I would look for. There are a lot of things that can be done in terms of soft power and people-to-people relations, and obviously a lot of that is happening. But what the Prime Minister can control the most is summitry.
Let me do two fingers on this. I thought you were going to ask, does the media make tensions between neighbors in Asia or any other region worse? And I would venture that yes, in many cases, the way that whether it's market-driven media or government-owned media, in many of these players in the region, the media is playing an escalatory role more than a de-escalatory role. And I would hope that I know this, people are going to say, well, you know, it's just diplomat asking us to say what the governments are saying, but that media would realize its own strength to influence public opinion and play a responsible role in reflecting what governments are actually trying to message to one another and to their peoples, rather than latching onto the most emotional statement available and always making that the headline.
You're right. Larry? Over. You're right.
Yoshi, you mentioned Mr. Abe made some statements that he would solve the Fatenma issue, and Mr. Tong, you expressed some optimism about that. But we have heard these promises and commitments from other Japanese leaders, and whenever I hear this, I always ask the question, how are you going to do it? Because it seems like the decision-making process regarding Futenma has such built-in paralysis in it, especially with regard to the role of the Okinawan government and behind the Okinawa government, the sentiments of the Okinawan people, that nothing can move on this issue. Did Mr. Abe or anybody else in the campaign try to address this how do you do it question with any specific ideas beyond what we've heard in the past?
Not that I know. No political leader when the LDP has provided specific procedures or plans for resolving the Futenma issue. So hopefully, I hope you're not right, but you may be right, because you may be seeing this continuation of sort of a stalemate situation. Except that I think Abe and the LDP government this time has clearly more political capital. I look at the results of the election in Okinawa. That has probably four constituencies, the districts, and three of them elected the LDP members. I think LDP made some advance there in terms of the representation on the national level. So that might be an indication that for Abe government to feel more confident to go ahead, even at the expense of opposition coming from the Okinawa community. But again, reluctantly, I say you could be right. I mean, you may not see any major progress for quite some time to come.
One thing the LDP did have going for it in the 55 system, you know, for most of the history, was that they had a political structure that extended down, party structure and factional structure that extended down to Okinawa and other districts that had bases. That started to break up in 93 with the new election rules, single seat districts, which made it harder, but it really fell apart under the DPJ. So I would think it might be possible with an LDP government to build a little more structure going from Tokyo down to the local level in Okinawa. But I also suspect that, to answer the question I asked Kurt, from my perspective, trying to move and use political capital on this before July upper house election, I would personally think would be hard. But there are some structural advantages the LDP had. The DPJ, although they had people who worked hard on it, didn't have. In fact, the DPJ was pretty much isolated on Okinawa politically. But that doesn't mean it's by any means easy. I think we have time for one more.
Hi, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the left. We haven't talked about that much, and particularly where left liberal sentiment among the public will shape the Abe administration and U.S.-Japan relations. Although the LDP won a resounding election, voter turnout was rather low. The DPJ is now in a period of rethinking itself. And so at least for the short or medium term, where do you think liberal voices will go? How will they react in the coming months?
The use of the word left that you came up with at the beginning, it's kind of, I haven't heard that for quite some time. So left, I think left in the Japanese actual politics, the left used to mean that in terms of sort of organized politics, those who oppose the Japanese-U.S. security treaty, and they sort of had a sympathy for Soviet Union or People's Republic of China. And then that paradigm clearly changed quite drastically. So in that sense, there's, if you look at the status of the Social Democratic Party, which is former Socialist Party of, I mean, formerly was a former, I mean, the Socialist Party of Japan, it's not really a viable political force. So now everyone accepts the alliance and security treaty with the United States. You know, anti-Americanism was a sort of a landmark, a hallmark of a Japanese left, but again, those days are gone. So maybe I should, as you use the word again, liberal voices, you know, that's, it's still there. I mean, it's in a very strong form, like a Kometo's call for, I mean, going more slowly, and even and taking measures for strengthening the U.S.-Japanese alliance, and then it's Kometo's opposition to the revision of the Constitution. That's clearly there, and it's then forced to be taken into account for any leadership. And if you include into liberal forces or liberal camp those who oppose the nuclear energy, it's there. It's a very, I was in Tokyo until 2 weeks ago, and every Friday. I don't know if some of you have gone to the Diet Building area. It was just every Friday evening the people show up in a massive number, calling for the cessation, removal of all the nuclear power plants. So it's not they're there, but I think they're. That's one aspect. On domestic issues, like liberal voices can still play a big voice. But in terms of external policies, national security policy, I think their voice is traditional voice coming from traditional left is a figure less and less.
I actually was going to say much the same thing, not doing a lot of political analysis of Japan, but that rather, when you talk about left versus right, I think perhaps very similarly to the United States, that is largely defined by pocketbook issues in the current environment. And people, again, want to go back to what I said during my presentation. The Japanese public is very focused on the state of the economy, and as we talk a lot about foreign policy issues, and again that dominated the conversation today. Really, that's what people are looking for in Japan, at least according to the opinion polls. And that's, I think that's a very interesting development.
It may be that I think it is the case that the right has won the debate, as Yoshi said, on foreign policy and national security. Although the left is still there, and the left seems scattered on single issues, anti-nuclear and or cautious on security, and hasn't congealed into a cohesive party or movement that captures a broad range of issues on the left. But the area I'm going to watch is the economic debate, where it doesn't fall into left-right categories very easily, but I think there are some very hard public policy choices. Abe-san's moving towards inflation targets of 2%, quantitative easing, infrastructure, Noda-san with the MOF backing him up was going more towards fighting the debt. Those are hard public policy choices. It may be that doesn't fall into neat left-right, but that may be the schism or that in the end starts to really shake up Japanese politics. We'll just have to wait and see, and maybe we'll be able to invite Kurt and Yoshi back. But for now, thank you both. Please join me in thanking our terrific speakers.